Welcome to Words First, talking text in opera. I became aware of playwright Jacqueline Goldfinger a couple of months ago when I interviewed composer Melissa Dumphy for this podcast. Jacqueline and Melissa both live in Philadelphia and are longtime friends. And it was Melissa that got Jacqueline into writing words for music. They've recently received an Opera America Discovery Grant for their opera Alice Tierney and will be premiering the work in 2023 at Oberlin Opera. In the meantime, however, Jacqueline has started work on a number of other projects with a number of composers, including Justine F. Chen, Guang Yang, and Kevin Lasky, and written a book about playwriting. I'll talk to her about all of these things and more on today's episode. But first, here's a conversation I had with soprano Alexandra Deschortes last December about her approach to text in various operatic genres and how truth has taken a backseat to pretty. Alexandra is looking to bring the ugly back. Here's our conversation.
I really believe that no matter the style, like you're going to go to Mozart and you're going to go to Donizetti, and it's a very, very rigid set of rules about style that I've always tried to bend a little bit, because I always think that partially, no matter how, like they said that, for example, Bellini would write first the melodies and then fit the words, but he still knew what the words were, or he still knew, if it was a text, what emotion and what message he wanted to create. It's just randomly, so he had a different process. But I believe that the connection between language and spoken word and spoken language and our culture is absolute. Like, you can see the difference in cultures from, like, I see my son with bilingual house, and it starts in infancy, how it forms your mind. It literally prunes your neural pathways a certain way. It literally neurologically makes you into who you are. You can see the difference between cultures when they have, for example, a language that is extremely easy to learn grammatically, but really hard to write, for example, or a language that has a lot to do with pitch, or a language, you know, you can tell the difference that it makes in terms of the people you're getting. Are they more driven towards poetry or to write, you know, dishwasher manuals? It's in the language. And so I was thinking about two really things that I love to sing, which is things that are very theatrical when you don't have to think so much about your vocal technique. And the utter opposite, which is bel canto, where I try to fit my sense of text and aesthetic along with that. And so I was thinking about, to me, the apogee of Donizetti, which is Roberto Devereux, and Elisabetta. And I was thinking about, I try to never think in translation. I either paraphrase or think in the language, which is why I'm very leery of singing in a language that I'm not fluent in. And which is, you know, to my advantage that I'm French, that I speak English, and that I can. Why I'm terrified when I have to learn something that is in a different language, because to me, not knowing how to speak the language and having, it's a horrible idea. So I love in the second act when she realizes that he doesn't really love her, that she knows it was a fantasy and she operated on these illusions, you know, being an elderly person already. And but she still delivers a text where you have alma infida, ingrato core, ti raggiunse il mio furore. And when you sing it, you don't even need to translate it, because if you look at the intervals and if you look at the largo and where it's going, you know, you have the alma infida, ingrato core, ti raggiunse il mio furore. You don't even need to translate that. Because there's so many shifts, and it really, for me, indicates what color. And I feel like these things were written to think about it, because otherwise it will sound very pretty and very beautiful and very technically perfect. And yes, you will put yourself in trouble vocally if you really express this, but I think it's worth it. Otherwise people tune you off and it's just pretty, and people start looking at the sets and at the costumes and they start applauding for pretty, not beautiful. Not because beautiful can mean beautiful, ugly, beautiful can mean a lot of things, but pretty is very narrow. And I noticed that people will start not even thinking that you're saying words. You might as well be singing the phone book.
Right.
Now, I think there is a value for some people in laying back and having the phone book read to them. Mm-hmm. It can be done very beautifully, and the beauty itself has its own aesthetic value, but I think it's very limited and very superficial. Mm-hmm. And so you do have to delve into the text and how the text is supplemented by rhythms. And sometimes people go, oh, but the composer put a weird rhythm there that doesn't go with the word. I'm like, well, make it fit, because somehow in his mind it made sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes we overestimate, and then some other people overestimate the markings. They're like, but he marked a forte piano. And I'm like, well, in proportion to this or the tempo markings. I think that that becomes pedantic on the other hand. Mm-hmm. And you really just, if you just center on the text, and you know, some of these things will come out right. Mm-hmm. And then some of these other things, if you went to the original story, you will discover that the editor didn't have enough space and he just added something.
Right. There's always a bit of that, I think, in older texts, especially where we can't actually ask.
Yeah. So, and I mean, I'm somebody who finds errors in scores all the time. And if you go back to the original, they go, ooh, you know, and I've met a lot of conductors who, because this is the only support material they want to understand, become incredibly pedantic. And it's not music anymore. It's solfège, you know. Right. So to find a balance, I mean, it all has to groove, you know. If I take a bit of space, I give it that, you know. So this, it's the same as in a conversation. So for me, that is something that I find in bel canto that is very underestimated, I think, in modern interpretation. Mm-hmm. It's mostly done because it has become a little bit the goal in opera to do pretty, because we're not theater.
Right.
And we have taken away the rights of the text. And if you can say a Shakespeare monologue 20 different ways, it's because there is a structure that allows you to superimpose interpretation. And I think there is the same thing going on here. The problem is that for that to be achieved, you have to be immersed in the text. Mm-hmm. You have to not just speak the language, but understand it poetically. Mm-hmm. And I know some people that are Italian that don't get it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I've had these discussions with Italians that I was like, why are you singing it this way? You're Italian. But it's because they're at the service of, oh, I need this to be pretty.
All right.
You know, and I understand pretty, but pretty is doing us a big disservice. And it does a disservice in theater. You would never let people express a character. You would never let somebody play the part of Macbeth or Hamlet in a pretty way.
No.
You would ask him to give you meaning, to give you an interpretation, to make these words sing. So that's really important to me. And my other text that I have is, you go to the opposite, which is
La Bohémienne
from Poulenc, where everything is at the service of the text.
Right.
Everything. I mean, like, and the meaning, you know, my favorite moment in that piece that really speaks to me is when there is a douloureux mais très simple, painful but very simple. Hier soir, j'ai voulu prendre un comprimé pour dormir. And it's really spoken. And then if you look at the pitches and if you look at the rhythm, it all fits. Je me suis dit que si j'en prenais plus, je dormirais mieux. Et que si je les prenais tous, je dormirais sans rêve, sans réveil. Je serais morte. I mean, it was, and she speaks about it. J'ai eu un rêve. And then she sings a dream, where she dreams that j'ai rêvé ce qui est. So she dreamt what happened in reality. And when she woke up and she realized the dream wasn't a real dream, but it was a projection of a wish. So all of this is, all the meaning is superimposed inside of little bars of word. I mean, the bar signature changes constantly because her mind keeps on fracturing and going almost back and forth in time. You will find that in Traviata as well. And that's what's fun. If I look at Traviata and I look at La Bohémienne, and you find the same fracturing. I've always thought of Traviata as like the introduction of Traviata is actually you start at the end and you go back in time.
100% yes, yes.
I almost wish that you could have this sensation that somebody at the moment of death is visiting their whole life over one last time. And that strangely enough, their life starts when they met the person that is the ultimate person that they will love.
Right.
So she forgot everything but that moment.
Yes.
And she sees her life flash in front of her eyes before she takes that last breath.
Yes.
So that's all in the text, though. You cannot make that work without really having a clear idea of where that person came from. That's why I wish that opera companies would do table reads. So we would all sit around and paraphrase our roles. I don't want to see a translation. I don't want to either you speak it in the text because you know the language and it's your language or whatever, or you paraphrase it in your own language, but paraphrasing, not translating, because that tells you a lot. Those are like one Freudian slip after the other when you're paraphrasing text. That's how I proceed. It's also because it triggers the memory very differently. And because of my own personal difficulty having no short-term memory, I need that. But I discovered that it has a validity in other than practical ways. It helps me become this person. And the rhythm of the words and how does the, you know how people do imitations of actors or politicians? Is that everybody has an accent. Everybody has a rhythm. Like we don't come from, as a human race, like everybody has some people more than others. You know, you see some amazing Christopher Walken impressions because if you hear it, it's Christopher Walken. The way he uses words, the way we do this. I mean, I worked extremely hard at getting rid of my French accent because I heard the word, oh, you're so cute too many times. And I would speak like this when I first arrived States and I had a very strong French accent, you know, and, oh, it's so cute. And I'm like, please, I am French. I am not cute. This isn't my accent. And over the years, I had to neutralize it because not only as a woman, I felt like I was not already being taken seriously, but on top of this with a cutesy accent, as in, if you see a man, it runs the opposite gamut. It was really important for me to speak the language of my characters, and that started with the thing they utter.
When you first pick up a role that you're learning, do you pick up the text first or the music first, or is it a combination in that first go around? What do you connect with initially when you're learning a role?
I go for the text. I tend to grab my score and start reading through it and putting my little markings and highlighting my text in a certain way. I need a lot of colors and a lot of markings.
Me too, yeah.
And then I listen to it while adding markings. I try to find an interpretation that's neutral but musically clean. And I listen to it if I can. If not, I get a friend that's a pianist and I have him play it so I can hear it and see if my first instincts were right. And for the purpose of memorization, every role, and then every composer aside from this, has a sort of key. And it's a little bit like the Rosetta Stone, individual Rosetta Stones for individual composers or pieces.
Yeah.
You have to go look for it. You have to find the moment that is the first, because I don't think they always write in order. And you have to find like the moment where that person connected with the text that they have to put in music and decided to put that first thing in music. Yeah. And from there, develop the language of the whole piece. And again, 90% of the time, it's a bit of text.
Yeah. And now, my conversation with Jacqueline Goldfinger. I spoke to her on April 23rd with her in Philadelphia and me still on my gig in San Diego. I was staying in a bungalow in the flight path, so you will hear a number of planes going over my head as we speak. Jacqueline, welcome to Words First. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here.
So you're a playwright first, and you have quite a resume of both performances and accolades, and I want to talk to you about the operas you've written, but I first want to know what drew you to playwriting and what you love about it.
I began writing plays before I knew they were plays. Okay. I grew up in a rural area in North Florida, right outside Tallahassee.
Okay.
And I always loved telling stories. My mom has stories of how I would make my own little books when I was, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old. And I would take them to the library for story time because I wanted her to read my book at story time.
Oh.
Cute and entirely narcissistic.
Yeah.
Because there were other people in the room who came for the other story. I just want to acknowledge that. So I've always been a storyteller, and growing up in the Deep South, while I was not surrounded by professional performing arts companies, we just have a phenomenal tradition of storytelling.
Yeah.
And so initially when I started writing stories, I was thinking that I was going to go along the like Kate Chopin, Carson McCullers, Flannery O'Connor, Zora Neale Hurston, Alice Walker, like that was kind of the path.
Okay.
I saw, but in middle school, my description got shorter and shorter, and my dialogue got longer and longer. So finally, my middle school English teacher was like, "You're actually not writing a story anymore. You're writing a play, and here's what a play is." And we didn't have any professional theater companies, but I had seen like skits at school mm-hmm. and things. And so I was very excited by that and that this was a thing. And so I started reading plays, and I was lucky enough to have a high school where we didn't have a drama program early on, but they would let you like do whatever you wanted in the cafeteria or in the auditorium space. And so really I came up through playwriting through the DIY fringe movement all the way through college and post-college
mm-hmm.
where, I was with my partner in San Diego because mm-hmm. he was finishing his studies at Scripps out there. And so I was with the Playwrights Collective that did site-specific work in Balboa Park.
Very
and
cool.
Things like that. So I came to playwriting because I love what I call moving arts, arts that move.
Yeah, time arts, they're the best.
Yes, they are. And they're transcendent. And to me, that makes them even more special.
Yeah.
Because you only have that one experience, even if it's technically the same show with the same text.
Yeah.
You only have that one experience that one night at that one time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's so beautiful.
There's something about the ephemeral aspect of theater, dance, any of those, yeah, moving time arts that just it blows me
yes.
away. And it's what drew me to it as well, that it just disappears. And of course, in our world now, it's not exactly the same. We've got so many recordings and, you know, it's just things get kept that we aren't expecting to get kept anymore. And I think there's a little bit of a loss in that, actually.
I do think there's a loss in it, but I think it's okay as long as we acknowledge that loss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I think about Shakespeare, whose plays weren't published until after he passed away.
Right.
And it's like he was never intending for them to be published. And so I'm absolutely sure that. So what happened was his friends all got together and like put together different versions of the plays and different scenes they had to make, quote unquote, the plays.
Yeah.
And they've been re-edited and republished millions of times. So again, like I'm sure it's not like none of us are watching the original Shakespeare. I'm sure there was something even more transcendent in that.
Yeah.
But at least we have it to refer back to.
Yeah.
And that's how I'm trying to, I was actually talking to a student about this the other day, get them to think about the video captured. It's that it absolutely loses something from the original in-person performance.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can show you a performance that's happening halfway across the world and say, this isn't everything, but look at this, or look at this aspect of it and learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's an opportunity for the performing arts to evolve quickly and in more exciting and diverse ways because we now have access to more. As long as the acknowledgement is absolutely made, it's not the same as in person.
I think that's such a great way of looking at it. You know, I think for those of us who have a glass half empty sort of way of looking at the world.
I acknowledge that that is, wow, that's a terrific way of looking at what video capture can do for us. But yes, you're right. Absolutely acknowledging that what you're seeing is a shadow of what it is that actually happened.
Absolutely.
In that space. You teach playwriting and dramaturgy workshops, and you've also written a book called Playwriting with Purpose, a guide and workbook for new playwrights. What percentage of your work is educating and giving back to the new generation of writers?
That's a great question, and it comes and goes. I'm incredibly lucky. I'm based in Philadelphia. We have a wonderful performing arts community, opera, theater, visual arts, dance, just across the spectrum. And so I've been able to arrange my life where I'll teach at a local university one semester and then work at a theater on a commission the next. And so I've been able to pretty much keep it 50-50 for a while. That's creeping up, which is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
It's just that as I'm expanding into opera and choral work, more of that time is being taken. But frankly, especially with, as you said, the book coming out, which is basically my 101, 102 class that
right.
I was encouraged to put into a book, they don't necessarily need me as much anymore either. Right? The book is being used by teachers all over.
Yeah.
So
that's great.
So that frees me a little. And honestly, as much as I love my students, it takes a lot to mentor and to pour yourself into someone else's work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm also trying to be cognizant that as I get older, I'm just tireder. I don't know if you've experienced that, like I just hit 40 and I'm like, all I want to do is like go to bed. Like I don't know what happened.
Your coffers get so full so fast.
What?
Yeah.
I don't have as much energy, so I've been focusing more on writing for professional performance.
Yeah.
But I think that is one of the things that we owe our communities. And I know that this is contested by some artists, mm-hmm. but our communities feed us in so many ways that I feel like feeding the next generation is something that is a social obligation that we should do.
We have so much, slapping up against us, in those of us who work in theater.
Absolutely.
And opera, that I feel like the more we can foster the continuation of our art form, the better it is. It's going to survive if we allow it to. So how did you find opera?
I actually found it through the Met at the AMC series.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I don't know if people know about that on your podcast, but the AMC movie theaters project a couple of the Met performances into mm-hmm. movie theaters. Mm-hmm. So if you could go on a special day, you can see it. And you could also, it's really cool because it's filmed so beautifully and both the performance and behind the scenes. So like during the intermission, you get to go backstage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And have Renee Fleming show you around and talk about opera. Like Renee Fleming was like the first opera name I knew.
Right.
And it was she just like blew the back of my head off. Like I was just like, oh my God. So the Met at the AMC and Renee Fleming introduced me to opera. And then when I was in my 20s after college, I moved around a bit. I moved to San Diego. I've lived kind of all over the country. And so I had the opportunity to go and see live opera.
Yeah.
And I completely agree. Like I thought nothing could get better than being in the movie theater seeing it.
Yeah.
And then I went and saw it live and I was like, holy curse word. like I was floored. Like, do other people know this exists?
Right.
I'm like looking around, I'm like, you know? And so I grew to love it. And I was very lucky because I'm in Philly. So we have fabulous opera company
mm-hmm.
in Philly. And then also I'm a short train ride to DC and Baltimore and New York and Boston and like all these places. And so I can bop around and go see things. And also I want to give a shout out to the reduced ticket programs, because also like one of the reasons I could see more things is because I could get reduced tickets the day of if I stood in line.
Yeah.
And so between the Met at the AMC and the reduced tickets, I was able to kind of start to learn and start my opera journey. in my mid-20s or so. And I fell in love with it. I never thought I would write it, mainly because I just didn't think that, this is going to sound really weird, but even though I try not to think hierarchically, I try and think of art as a vista rather than a hierarchy.
Sure.
That like everyone's in their vista and their community doing what their community needs. And that is beautiful and important, which I absolutely believe in. I still had this like, I'm not smart and elite enough to write opera. Like, I'm just not.
It's such a stigma. It's such an odd stigma with opera that we all approach it as we enter the, you know, I mean, I felt the same way when I found opera too. And I don't know what that is, but we do have that. There is this stigma attached to the art form. And it's too bad.
It really is, because I mean, people operas should be booked up. Like, what a better expression of our crazy curse word time,
right? True.
Than these stories, which are so overblown and yet so human. I mean, isn't that what you know, every gossip column is? Isn't that what most internet stories are? Like, it's the perfect art form for how we are telling and consuming stories at this time. So the fact that like every opera is not sold out blows my mind.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is some of that stigma. And I definitely came with that. I mean, my parents my parents are wonderful. And my parents really appreciate what most people call folk art, which I mean, that term, you could have a whole conversation about that term.
Oh yeah, that's a whole podcast.
Yeah. But like they never took me to the opera. They never took me to the theater. They thought that stuff was kind of boring and elitist. And so one of the cool things has been me being able to kind of share with my family things that I'm learning and show them things the way I see them. And so, you know, my sister now takes her daughter to, you know, the Academy of the Arts, some of the family classical music stuff.
That's great.
So it's been a whole journey for me and my family. And especially for me. And so the point being is basically Melissa Dunphy, whom is a wonderful composer and I've been friends with for a long time, but we hadn't like sat down and wrote anything together. We both moved in kind of the same theater circles in Philly because she also does sound design and performance. Right. She was like, I need some words for these choral things. And I love your words. Write me some words. I'm like, I can't write words for that. Like, I don't know. I don't read music well and I can't. And she's like, bitch, write me some words. Text them to me on Friday. Bye. And so I that was how I got into it. It was basically she just believed I could do it and didn't give me an option.
Thank God for those people, right?
Oh my goodness. Like I will be indebted to her for the rest of my life. So yes, that's how I got into it. And then she got the Oberlin Commission. And so we've been working on that together.
That's awesome. You know, I was looking at your works on your website and I want to talk about a number of them to veer into the opera world. So now it's like you've collaborated with a number of people. Like that started you on a full journey into opera, which I think is so fantastic. And I want to ask you, now that you've been splitting time writing plays and libretti, do you approach writing libretti the same as writing a play, or do you find it to be a different skill set?
Oh, it's a totally different skill set. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that interests me about it, is that it is, it's shorter. So that's an obvious example.
Right. Sure.
It doesn't quite have to be quite as literal because people aren't listening to every single word. And so you have the opportunity to both let the music tell the story and the performer's emotionality, but you also have a chance to like not have to worry about explaining things in such detail. But the balance of that is that if you don't have enough specificity and nuance, then it becomes stereotype.
Right.
Right. So I find that there are a number of differences, but one of the major differences is finding that balance of nuance and kind of versus leaving story moments open and emotion moments open so the actor can fill them with their music. It's a very different balance. which I find an incredible challenge and really exciting.
So let's talk about some of the operas that you've written or that you're working on. So tell me a little bit about, now, is it TWA or is it Toi that you wrote
It's Toi.
I love that. And so this is a collaboration with composer Justine F. Chen. And your description says that it's inspired by a popular folk ballad. How do you weave the themes of the ballad into the story?
So this is a ballad that Justine brought to me.
Uh-huh.
And we're currently working on it. Not the ballad, working on an opera based on it.
Right.
And it is a ballad about two sisters who live together, and then one is exposed to the greater world, and mm-hmm. they both fall in love with the same man. And the one who's exposed to the greater world kind of becomes a little bit evil and drowns her other sister so she can have the dude.
Yeah, you know, like you do.
It's like
regular sister stuff.
Yeah, no. Like, I tell people it's like in Hamilton.
Yeah.
If Angelica, instead of being generous and knowing her sister needs Hamilton and so lets her sister marry him even though she's in love with him, like if Angela would have turned evil, Angelica would have turned evil.
Yeah.
So it's incredible to me this idea of, in that time, mm-hmm. how you experienced the world and got stories and got information was the sister, one of the sisters went into the village, the other one didn't, basically.
Right.
Our time, it's going online.
Right.
So I think really what it is a story about where do you get your stories and perspectives? How is your lens made through which you see the world?
Mm-hmm.
Our version is a little less stark in terms of good, bad.
Right.
And more about how what you consume changes how you see the world and therefore changes your actions.
Wow. Yeah.
And asking those questions in a contemporary context, including social media and the internet.
Wow. Yeah. And where are you in the development process of this piece with her?
Right now we're outlining because we want to make sure this is a bigger piece than just in terms of bodies mm-hmm. and in terms of kind of epicness of storytelling than either of us have told before. So we're right now going back and forth with an outline to mm-hmm. make sure that we cover all our bases. And in the meantime, we've got a commission to write a mini opera.
Okay.
A short opera, which will be about 20 minutes together, about Justine's father.
Oh, cool.
Which is really cool. And so that'll be out this fall, but I can't tell you the name of it yet because it hasn't been announced yet.
Yeah.
But so we're working on those two things right now.
Fantastic. Yeah. And how did you meet Justine?
Actually, through Opera America.
Okay.
Melissa and I won an Opera America Discovery Award grant mm-hmm. for our opera Alice Tierney.
Yes, I want to talk about that too. So we'll get to that next.
Absolutely. And Justine and her librettist, Stephanie, won for Seven Sisters.
Yes, that's right. Okay.
So we were all asked to do this like conversation about art. And Justine and I just really, really clicked. And so there was this idea that Justine had been wrestling with that no librettist had been able to kind of crack for her.
Mm.
And so I was able to crack it. And so we've just been working on it ever since. So I guess that was last year,
okay.
late last year that was announced.
Very cool. So let's talk about Alice Tierney. So Melissa mentioned this during her interview with me, and it says that it's premiering at Oberlin in 2023. And
yes.
This is very exciting. Congratulations for your Discovery grant. And you say this piece is in the style of Rashomon. I'm assuming you're referring to the Kurosawa film.
Yes. Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about the story? And how it relates in that way.
Absolutely. So I know you interviewed Melissa.
Yep.
If you ever have a chance, you have to go to Melissa's house.
Okay.
Because she, first of all, her house is fantastic. Second of all, she and her partner bought an old theater and they live in the apartment above the old theater. And they're personally DIY redoing, have ripped out and are redoing the entire inside of the theater so she can have an experimental music club in her first floor.
Awesome.
Isn't that amazing?
Cool. Yes.
So they're in the middle of construction now. So yeah, like it's so cool to see now because like half the stuff is torn down and half it's not.
Wow.
But when they were doing that project, and she has a podcast about it called The Bog House.
Nice.
But when they were doing that project and they started excavating, they found out that the building was on top of old outhouses. That's why it's called The Bog House.
Mm-hmm. And
in the 1700s and early 1800s, when that area was a busy port area, when people would leave or come through, they would throw all their trash into the outhouses, right? So there are like these huge 10-foot round holes, wells that look like wells underneath her foundation.
Wow.
That are full of artifacts.
Yeah.
Incredible. But one of the women who lived in the house, which at the time was sometimes was a house of ill repute, sometimes was a pub, was a woman named Alice Tierney. And Alice, there's not a lot of information on her, but the information we do have is that she probably came from some kind of upper class family because she had behavior and mannerisms like that.
Mm-hmm.
And she ran this rockin' boarding house. Men nice. And women and women, whomever. She was a party girl. She would throw all female parties often. She just was like this fun, incredible party girl. And so she's kind of a legend in Philadelphia history.
Right.
But what's interesting is that because there's not as much known about her, and because, and this is where we got the Rashima idea, she was found murdered.
Oh, that's where it starts to get interesting. Solved. Yeah.
She's this perfect container for us to look at how we decide whose story to tell and how to tell it.
Yeah, right.
Which is one of Melissa's big themes that she's interested in exploring in most of her work.
Yeah.
And so what we do is that we have archaeology grad students who are finishing their thesis project. And to get their PhDs, they have to excavate this house mm-hmm. where Alice lived and write a big dissertation on who she was. And so what we see is these four very different graduate students with four different backgrounds and points of view taking their part of what they think is important about what they've excavated and telling Alice's story. And then we summon that Alice. So by the end, you have the four grad students and all four of their Alices on stage.
That's very cool. Yeah.
And they're all very different Alices. Yeah. And it's one of those, I think, big questions that we're asking in our society today is who tells the story, who shapes the story, what story do you believe?
Yeah.
So we don't give you an answer, but we leave you with that question.
See, I love that. I love not being given the solution. I know that's not everybody's yeah. cup of tea, but I love it when something ends and I'm sitting there with a million questions. I think that's the best.
Me too. And I feel like you can get away with that if you do it well mm-hmm. in terms of giving people a full story.
Exactly.
So you'll still get a full story with a beginning, middle, and end that feels satisfying, but those questions linger above it.
Yeah.
And that's when I found that type of ending most satisfying as well.
That's awesome. Where are you in the process with this? I mean, this is getting a premiere here and 2023 sounds far away, but it's actually... That's shockingly not.
So we've done a libretto workshop, and mm-hmm. so we've got the libretto really solid, and Melissa's writing music right now, and we have our first music workshop this winter.
Oh, that's awesome. That's exciting.
So this one is much further along. And we have a couple companies interested in a second production.
Mm-hmm.
They're just waiting to hear more of the music, I think. So hopefully in 2023, you'll get to see a couple of Alices.
Very cool. How much have you written with Melissa? Because, you know, I was looking at her website and your website, and I think you both have quite a few things that have made it out there. Choral works, short works, and now, of course, this opera that's about to premiere.
Yeah, I mean, I think technically, like, if just in terms of opera, we've only been working together for, you know, a year, year and a half.
Right.
But it was a couple of years ago when she started asking me to write short bits for things. Mm-hmm. Also, often in theater, sound designers will have little bits of verbiage they need or something.
Right.
And I've written
yeah.
that for people. But what I've loved is that we've got the choral work. We got Voices 8, which was an incredible group. Did beautiful work in London, and we worked with the Muse Singers, which did gorgeous work in New York. And it was nice to kind of build our collaboration muscles slowly mm-hmm. over the course of a year or two. Mm-hmm. So that when we got into this opera, we had that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that really made the libretto workshop and all the workshops going forward probably more productive.
Right. Very cool. I want to talk about Fire on the Water with Guangyang.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a piece about physicist Chen Xiongwu, who is part of the Manhattan Project. And I have to tell you, my physicist husband would be going nuts over this story. So
him to tell somebody to give us money.
I will. He's at Oak Ridge National Lab. So he's like all in with the Manhattan Project. Yeah. So as I was reading about this, I was like, oh, I have to tell Matt about this. This is about a Chinese woman who was involved in the Manhattan Project and got sort of passed over for Nobel Prize offerings.
Yes, twice.
Twice, which, you know, I would say
on
is shocking,
projects.
But it's not shocking.
It's not.
Is this
Chinese-American woman, twice, all the men who were the other lab leaders in both labs got the prize for two different projects.
Of course.
But they didn't give it to her.
And who did all the work? No, I'm just kidding. But,
right?
You know, but
no, but they brought, both times, they brought her in to be a senior scientist and solve problems they could not solve.
Yep.
Then once she solved them, they got the prize for it.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. It's, you know, the boys asking you to do their homework for them. And then, you know,
yep.
There you go. So do you approach this piece, or are you approaching this piece as a true narrative biographic piece, or are you looking at it, telling the story in a more poetic fashion?
So we are just in the discussion stages of this
cool.
one. So it's very early in the process. Right now, we're thinking it's going to be more poetic and heightened. I don't know if you've heard Guan's beautiful work.
I haven't.
I think it's on Spotify. If you just search for it, or if you go to her website, you can click through.
Okay.
One of the reasons that I connected with her was I heard her work online, and she's Chinese, but she's training in America.
Okay.
And so at USC, Thornton School of Music. She combines kind of what we think of as classical Western, what Americans think of as kind of classical Western music, with these gorgeous Chinese tones and Chinese traditional instruments.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's very cool.
So she actually ended up getting stuck because of COVID, and like it's been a crazy thing.
Yep.
So, but what we're hoping is that once she can get back and communication is better and more fully engaged and China stops, you know, turning off email for everyone, that we'll be able to find a funder, because this is, it's an extraordinary story, and we think we found a really original way to tell it musically.
Yeah, I feel like just the tiny little blurb that you have on your site about this, I was like, oh yeah, this is a story that needs to be told. So that's, I have high hopes. My fingers are very crossed for you, because I think definitely these tales are the ones that we need to start hearing more and more.
Absolutely. And there's such, like, this is what I tell people, is I know it seems scary sometimes when you're going into, you know, new waters, whether it's thematics or character or story. But the reality is that's where best opera has always been made.
Yes.
Like, the operas that we play, that we perform today as classics, often were those new steps.
Yes.
So if we want to have opera modern opera that resonates and that lasts, both things, then those new steps are what's going to get us there.
Yeah.
You know, and we can do it with intention and thoughtfulness and not be like colonizers about it, because we all know that's happened, yes. Even in beautiful music, which is one reason that I wanted to collaborate on this project with someone who was actually Chinese.
Right.
And bringing that experience and that sound into it.
Did you bring the story to her? Did she bring the story to you?
I brought it to her. Mm-hmm. I'd actually read about the scientist in one of my children's books.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And so I was like, wow, she's fascinating. And I started researching her and I found her to be fascinating. But I couldn't find the sound that I thought would work the best with the story. Mm-hmm. And so it was about a year before I came, someone recommended this composer's site, and I started listening to her music. I'm like, this is the sound I've been waiting for, mm-hmm. that's going to best tell this story.
Nice. I actually want to talk to you about your relationship, your collaborative relationship with Kevin Lasky. So talk to me is you're working, are you working on Queen of the Goths? Where are you? Is this in an early stage? Have you been working on it?
Yep. Queen of the Goths, the libretto is pretty much done. Mm-hmm. We've workshopped it and got that done. And Kevin has made some demos.
Okay.
And so we're hoping that when the new rounds of grants come up, we'll be able to apply.
Shove that in their faces.
Yes. Because Kevin's done some gorgeous, gorgeous work.
Yep.
And it's a piece that, that I think it is kind of less what we think of as traditional contemporary opera.
Okay.
And more those classical tones, because it's set in Florida.
Yep.
It's set during the Victorian age. Mm-hmm. It's set in a primarily rural area. Mm-hmm. That he brings in these beautiful soundscapes, mm-hmm. and uses the sound in a slightly different way. And so I'm really excited about it. And I think it will appeal to a whole different opera type audience.
How much do you actually draw on Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus? Because you say that that's an influence, but is it a really loose influence, or are you taking the story and really transferring it into a different space?
So yes, so it's called Queen of the Goths because it is the Titus Andronicus story from the queen's point, mm-hmm, of view.
Right.
Right. So for folks who don't know Titus Andronicus, big war in a not terribly clearly specified place. Titus, one of the things that happens is that the winning general, Titus Andronicus, takes the queen into his camp, and captures her. And one of the things that I've always been interested about in the play itself is that if you look at the parts of the play where things are being messed with and things are going wrong and will eventually lead to the downfall of Titus Andronicus, almost all the time, the queen is engaged in somehow in those moments, or she is conspicuously missing. Mm-hmm. And for me, what always came to my mind when I read that play was the queen is clearly got caught on purpose, is screwing him up from the inside so that he will fall and she can win the war because her side is out of resources and soldiers and such. No one else ever saw it that way, but that's fine. I like it. I like it that way. And so that's the story I tell. So while like Titus Andronicus is still a character, and there are some of the tent pole, the big scenes that, uh-huh, people know, the story is completely flipped. So you're getting, awesome, it from her perspective as she slowly destroys his empire from within.
Fantastic. That's so cool. I love that. Yeah.
It's really fun. And I said it because the Shakespeare is set kind of in this nether time, nether place.
Yep.
And I'm from Florida and I know a lot about Florida history. There were these huge land wars, yeah, during the Victorian era in Florida. And so I said it during the land wars because it gave us a real opportunity. And not only was it fun and the costumes are fun and all that, the sound is fun, but it gave us a real opportunity to look back very lightly at like, what are the resonances with America being constantly, yeah, in a state of war?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it allowed us to give some depth to those ideas, while still remaining this like crazy, off the wall, fun story.
Yeah, that's very exciting. Have you done work with Kevin before? Have you done any short works with him, or is this your first collaboration?
This is my first collaboration with Kevin. I met him through Julia Bumke, who's a phenomenal opera dramaturg. And I've seen quite a few of his works because he got his PhD in Penn, at Penn in Philly. So I've really admired his works, but this was the first one. But I actually, so here's the thing. You know, when you're learning something on your own, you don't really know how things work.
Right.
Like, you're just kind of figuring it out. So like when I started writing librettos and I really liked it, libretti, and I really enjoyed it, I just kept writing them. Like, it didn't occur to me that like I should wait for a composer. I was just like, I'm going to write this cool thing and then I'm going to listen. And then when the right composer comes by, I'll throw it at them and see if it sticks.
Sure.
So that's what they're doing. Not with Justine's Trois, because that was actually from a folktale she brought me. So that's a little different. But the other ones are pretty much, I've either written full libretti, like with Queen of the Goths and Alice Tierney, or like with our physics one, I have sections where I think I know what scenes are. And then I found composers. So that's, and then somebody the other day was like, that's not how we do it in opera. And I'm like, but you could.
It's true.
Like, you could. Like, here's the thing. I work in live theater primarily. That's how I was trained. The best idea in the room wins.
Yep. Always. Yep.
Always.
Yep.
So like the idea that the idea couldn't come from the composer, like that doesn't make any sense to me. Or couldn't come from the librettist. That doesn't make any sense to me. Sorry about that. So that's kind of how I've pursued it. And what I love is collaboration. So when people ask, is it hard to let these ideas go? It's, for me, it's not, because this is how I was trained, is you have to let things go. And that's what makes it transcendent, right?
Yeah.
That feeling the audience gets, it's not because I always chose the best word for that moment. I mean, I try to, but it's not that. It's the word and the performer and the director who directed the performer to do it that way, and the lighting designer, right? It's all of humanity in transcendence working together in rhythm. That's what gives us the kind of ethereal beauty that is performing arts. So I don't worry about like what collaborators are going to do. I'm excited by what collaborators are going to bring.
Yeah, I love that. I, you know, as a director, I mean, I'm just thinking about how that translates for me as a director, that, you know, when I walk in the door to direct a piece, I usually have the whole thing totally 100% planned out, but that also doesn't mean that it can't be blown apart by the ideas that come in the room. You know, I just want to make sure there's a backup plan in case nobody has any ideas but me. And, you know, that's my own control thing. But I do think that that's the nature of collaboration, is a whole bunch of prepared people walking in the door and then figuring out where the best idea is coming from in that group. And so I think this is a really interesting way of looking at approaching writing these pieces. I think that's great.
Thank you. I got it from the Coen brothers. I stole it. They did an interview years ago. Maybe it was a Sundance interview. I don't remember. They did an interview years ago, and they're basically, they plan everything to the nth because they want to make sure it's as good and brilliant as they can make it.
Yep.
And then when they go on set and someone is like, oh, that's as good as you can do, I can up that, Annie.
Exactly.
They're like, and we're going to go with your idea and claim credit for
that's
it.
That's right.
So, but like, that was their thing, is that like, if we can get the best out of ourselves, that leaves space for everyone else to bring the best of themselves and to create the most exciting work.
Yeah. Show me what you got. Because, you know, if someone walks in the door, I love it when a singer walks in the door and I start to direct something and they're like, or, and I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yes.
that's what it should be. Yeah. It's the best.
Yeah. And I have to say, that's something, we're working with Christopher Mirto at Oberlin Opera. And that's one of the things that he is training his students to do beautifully.
Yeah.
That he is training his students to be those kind of active listeners and thinkers and responders as artists. And that is really cool to see, especially in the young artists, and to see that grow.
Yeah, that's great. Can you talk to me just reaching sort of the end of our time here, and I want to ask you just one more question about just what the stories are that you... It's a two-part question. What are the stories that you'd like to be telling right now? I mean, you obviously have a bunch in your list, and just in terms of just like the overall overarching themes that you're looking at right now, but also, do you think we have a responsibility as creators right now to be telling certain stories moving forward?
That is an excellent question. I think we have the responsibility to be conscientious in what we choose and to understand the world outside the doors of the theater or opera house and take that all into consideration of what we choose. When we say obligation to tell certain stories, that makes me nervous. And this is probably the Jewish side of me. Was that it gives an opportunity to narrow in a way that may not be useful. So I, you know, and when we narrow, a lot of people get left out.
That's right.
And as a Jew, that's something that I'm conscious of, but I think that we do have the responsibility to be more conscientious in what we choose and how we work in the past. For example, the making sure you get, there's this great saying that I first heard from the trans community about that's nothing about us without us. That making sure you get the people in the room who actually can tell that story.
Yeah.
Whether or not they're the same people you've worked with or not.
Yeah.
But I think that expanding the story and perspective is just going to bring more people to opera. It makes such a difference in terms of if people feel connected. You know, we talked a little bit about that kind of elitism ceiling, that kind of the not feeling like you belong there or smart enough there. And like if you start to see a range of different people and stories on the stage, that ceiling crumbles.
Yeah, that's true. And that's the ultimate goal, I think. It's just open every door you possibly can.
Yeah. So I, you know, I love watching one of the more classic operas. At Philadelphia Opera, and then I love going to Opera Philadelphia and seeing the new works. And I wish that every place in the country could have that kind of balance in the work that they have on their stages.
Jacqueline, thank you so much for speaking with me. This has been great. This is a great conversation. I appreciate it.
This is wonderful. I hope we get to actually have a conversation in person at some point.
Likewise.
That'd be great.
Thank you to Jacqueline Goldfinger and Alexandra DeShortis for their insight. And thank you for listening. I'm Keturah Stikkan. If you'd like to hear these interviews in their entirety, as well as bonus materials and outtakes, you can become a patron of my podcast by going to patreon.com/wordsfirstpodcast. That's patreon.com/wordsfirstpodcast. All of my episodes from every season are available at wordsfirst.buzzsprout.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Words First is recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. A special thanks to Matthew Doucet, Elizabeth Coppinger, and Richard Stikkan for their generous support. Aurélie Doucet for the logo, Eileen Downey for the Mozart, and Randy Ravioli for the minimal barking. Until next time, take care of each other and keep telling stories.